This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, of course, this is The Deep Dive, as it is every Friday morning at 9 o'clock or just after the news. And I'm your host, Brooke Spector. On The Deep Dive, we usually do interviews about international relations or politics, economics, sometimes literature and the arts. But we're going to veer away from those themes for just a minute. We're going to do some science. And it's basic science, not in the sense of simple science, but basic as in fundamental building blocks kind of science. We're going to talk and learn something about dark matter. It's not a science fiction film. It's dark matter. It's real, although no one knows what it is. And the reason why we're doing this is my attention was caught by a new planned project in South Africa, and it's been in the news. And what it is outside of Paarl, there are plans afoot to build a research facility to search out dark matter without being bothered by anything else. No cosmic rays, no anything else. It's been in the news, and my attention was caught even further by the fact that one of the leaders of the project, one of our two guests, turns out is a cousin of my wife. And I could not avoid chasing after this topic and the people involved because of that. I thought there was a certain obligation. I'm interested in it also. As a child, I desperately wanted to be an astronomer, and I built a telescope. This was during the Sputnik age, way back in, 100 million years ago. I built my own telescope, and eventually I discovered that to do it for real, you actually had to learn and love things like calculus. And that began to weigh heavily upon me. And so I went off and did other things. But our two guests, obviously, this was not their problem. And so we're pleased today to have Robert Lindsay and Richard Newman, both of whom did not find calculus to be a brick wall. In fact, it became central to their life's work. Robert Lindsay, he's in charge of the National Nanotechnology Postgraduate and Teaching and Training Platform. This is a coalition of programs in four South African universities, UWC, where he sits, University of Johannesburg, University of Free State, and Nelson Mandela University in Gqeberha. And then Professor Richard Thomas Newman, as I say, a cousin of my wife, so there's a family issue here. And he's an associate professor in physics at Stellenbosch University, and he's a leader of this Paarl Africa Underground Laboratory, which has a more mellifluous acronym, PAUL, as opposed to NTPTTTP. But in any case, I really welcome both of you folks to join us today on The Deep Dive. Let me just sort of begin this by saying that I understand that this is going to be Africa's first deep underground science lab with a lead time of, half a decade or more to get it established in the Detoitskloof Mountains, branching off from an extension of or revision of the tunnel. And I guess the questions for me to start with, and I'll open it. Why deep underground and dark? If someone tells me dark matter makes up 85% of the universe, but we've never seen it, and I can't hold it in my hand, and there's no place where I can go buy some, how do we know it even exists? And I will let the two of you work this out for me. And I have lots of other questions, but let's start with that. Why underground, as opposed to a simulation in a supercomputer lab somewhere? And how do we even know there is such a thing as dark matter? Robert, Richard, somebody, one of you two guys has to tell me all this.
To give an analogy, which I think is quite useful for people to understand the rationale for going underground. So imagine you have a nicely cut lawn, nice green lawn, and you have growing in the middle of the lawn a daisy. And this is your object of interest, this daisy that is growing on the lawn. But now imagine the lawn grows and the grass is becoming longer and longer. Eventually, that daisy will be obscured by the grass that is growing taller and taller. And eventually, if you're standing on the side of the lawn, it will be impossible for you to see that daisy. So in the parlance of physics, we say that in this case, the grass is a background, a source of background, and the object of interest, the daisy, is our signal. So basically, we need a way to cut grass, to mow the lawn, as it were, and preserve the daisy. And in a similar way, what we do with experiments underground is that we use the mountain, for example, in the case of a tunnel, the mountain overburden as a way to, in a sense, cut the grass. And in this case, the grass is being caused by cosmic rays that are coming from outer space, from outside the Earth's atmosphere, interacting with atoms and molecules in the atmosphere and then producing secondary particles. And some of these secondary particles then constitute a background, basically grass. And if you are busy with a very sensitive measurement where you're looking for a very rare event, like in this case, the daisy, the secondary particles can swamp your signal and you cannot distinguish the daisy. So that is a sort of a simple way of looking at the rationale for going underground. There are two modalities that are used across the world to do underground physics. The one is to go and build a lab off a tunnel, like we are proposing. The other is to go down a mine and then locate your experimental cabins down the mine and do your experiments there. So that is the reason why we are going underground. I was mentioning with my analogy of the daisy and the grass, I was referring mainly to elementary particles called muons, which are basically heavy electrons that are produced by these cosmic rays interacting with the atoms and molecules in the atmosphere. But there are other sources of background. And as you mentioned, we have this idea of natural radioactivity. Basically, all materials are radioactive to some extent. And when I say radioactive, I mean that there are some nuclei that are naturally unstable. They want to decay and reach a state of stability. And you will find, for example, in your granites, as you mentioned, in the rock materials and so on, you will have the what we call the uranium series radionuclides that are present. In other words, you have uranium as a parent, and then you have these so-called daughters of uranium, many of which are also radioactive, giving off various particles. So one type of radiation that is given off by this natural radiation are gamma rays. So that is why you will not be able to use the mountain overburden to shield out the gamma rays, but you'll need some additional shielding in your laboratory cabin. So, for example, a typical shielding material is lead, which absorbs a lot of the gamma rays. So you basically then have the mountain to attenuate your muons coming from the cosmic ray interactions. And then you have other shielding like lead to shield more local radiation inside your cabin like gamma rays. So that's a very good observation. Yes, it's in other words, the grass is not just due to the muons, but it's also due to other radiation, more local, closer to your experimental setups in the cabin.
I still remember some high school physics. Robbie, you were going to add to Richard's explanation as to why we're doing this and how we're doing it.
Yes. No. Hi, Brooks. You've asked good questions and made a good comment there about the natural radiation, which is a problem. I'm glad I found a kindred spirit. When I was in high school, I wanted to become an astronomer as well. And then I eventually ended up doing physics because I thought, well, we can't find out enough about these stars. I mean, we've only got their light coming to us. But of course, now I know that I'm wrong. I mean, South Africa is doing great out of radio telescopes. We are the host of the Square Kilometer Array, as many of the listeners will know. The radio telescopes can therefore see the in the radio spectrum, and so they can pick up radio waves. And my astronomer colleagues at UWC learn a lot from these radio waves. But okay, there are other things in nature which we don't quite understand. There are lots of things that we don't know. So we've now got cell phones and all of this thing, these things which would look like magic or would have been magic even when I was in high school. Now we are used to them, and those have all been built by new developments in science. And so things start off as a basic science, which then often ends up in practical applications. But I must say, looking for dark matter is a really weird one, because we really don't know what it is We've always found that finding new things do help. Richard's analogy of the grass is pretty good. Another analogy would be if I look out my window now, I see blue sky. Now, if I looked at the same window this evening, I will see stars. Why don't I see stars now? Well, of course, it is because all this sunlight is being scattered off the atmosphere, and that's why I'm seeing all this blue light and I cannot see the stars. And what we're trying to do is to try and see the dark matter, which we think will interact with our instruments, but in a very, very weak way. So we've got to get rid of all other stuff which is going to mess things up. In this case, there are, as Richard explained, the cosmic rays and the local radiation. The radiation coming from the rocks, that's not so bad because we can stop those. The energies, but the cosmic rays, the things which hit the atmosphere, those energies are huge. There are not many of them, so there's not enough energy that we can solve ESCOM's problem, but they are so energetic that they will go through a lot of rock, which is why we want to build this underground tunnel, underground laboratory in the Huguenot tunnel outside Paul.
I'm going to have to interrupt for a sec. We have to do a station break and a commercial message, but hold on to that thought about the why, and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And today we have Robert Lindsay and Richard Newman, both of them associated with PAUL, not a person, but a new project for dealing with the mysterious, the ineffable dark matter. They're going to build a lab underneath a mountain in Paarl. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. I'm your host. And today's guests, Richard Newman and Robert Lindsay. Richard Newman with Stellenbosch University and Robert Lindsay with University of the Western Cape. And both of them connected to PAUL is not a person. PAUL is the lab that's going to be built underneath a mountain in the Paarl area to look for dark matter. It sounds like a science fiction novel, doesn't it? We're going to be dealing in dark matter. But gentlemen, how do we even know there is dark matter if we can't see it, we can't weigh it, we can't put a bucket on the table of the stuff? Doesn't show up on our radar. Is this just a guess to sort of round out the confusions in the equations? Ether used to be 150 years ago to sort of explain how light traveled and sound moved. How do we even know that you're chasing after something that's real?
The evidence for dark matter is really based on astronomical observations. So astronomers have managed to study, for example, the rotation of galaxies, and they've noticed that there are some anomalies in their understanding of that rotation. Turns out there must just be a lot more mass to explain the observations that were made with regards to that rotation. That was the one aspect, the so-called study of the galaxy rotational curves. And basically, by introducing this dark matter, they can explain what is observed. The other is that they have found some evidence of what is called gravitational lensing, where you have a large mass of matter which bends light. And this bending of the light causes an optical illusion. So you get, for example, a doubling up of an image. And again, because of the absence of visible matter in the region where they observe this gravitational lensing, they infer then that there has to be a large mass that is present, a dark matter mass, which then is responsible for this gravitational lensing, because the dark matter does interact gravitationally. So it's really evidence based on astronomical observations. Robert, you can add in?
This sounds as if it's not important, but it is actually a fundamental problem for physicists. I mean, we all learned at school about gravity, and Newton discovered gravity and looked at things and explained things very well. And this explains why the Earth is moving around the sun and why all the planets move around the sun. And scientists calculate this extremely accurately, and we can predict exactly where Saturn will be on the 25th of June in 2099 and whatever. These equations work perfectly. I mean, in a sense, the explanation that Newton came up with and the fact that we can predict where planets will be and so on is probably the best example of classical mechanics working extremely well. And a lot of what we do in science is we predict things and we believe and we get the answers and it works perfectly. And gravity, from that sort of classical point of view, is pretty well understood. I mean, if you wrote an article now to say that Saturn's orbit's going to change dramatically because you read it in the science, scientists would laugh at you. I mean, they wouldn't take you seriously at all. However, as Richard said, when people then looked at galaxies, which is just a combination of lots of stars, and there are many, many galaxies in the universe, and you can look through a telescope and see how the stars move. And in a sense, it's the same sort of thing as with the solar system, where you have different bodies and they interact via gravity, and so one should be able to predict pretty well what they're doing. When you do this calculation and you predict where a certain bright star in some galaxy should be moving, you get the wrong answer, and badly wrong. There's a clear indication that the only way that this makes sense is if there is a lot more matter in that universe, a lot more things affecting the gravitational effect on the stars. And this has been around for decades. When I was a student in England, that was mentioned many moons ago. And everybody thought, oh, well, maybe the observations are wrong, or maybe gravity is different, or maybe there's dust. Or there were lots and lots of different explanations until about between 20 and 30 years ago. Astronomers came up and said, well, no, this is clear. There is something here which we cannot see. We cannot see with our eyes. Now, that's not a problem because we can't really see atoms. We can't see infrared rays. We can't see radio waves. But yet we can listen to Chai FM, and we don't doubt a second that the radio waves are traveling from the antenna right to our radio. So we believe in lots of things that we can't see. Now, dark matter, similarly, people look at how the stars behave in galaxies, and they say, no, these things are moving in the wrong way. There must be something else affecting the stars.
Let me ask you a question, because I'm not sure I understand something. Is dark matter the same as antimatter, or is that yet another problem to be solved?
No, it's not the same as antimatter. What people discovered a long time ago in the laboratory is that if you have an electron, for example, you have an antimatter electron as well, which we call a positron. And so all matter has antimatter equivalents, but somehow in the universe, we believe, and we could be wrong, but we believe that most of the matter that we see is all normal matter and not antimatter. Antimatter only gets created when you have a lot of energy and something happens and you will create antimatter, but most of it will disappear after a while. So dark matter is not antimatter. Dark matter seems to be a different type of material. What we don't know anything about, if you like, to our abilities. Yeah. And it's always good to know that the top scientists have no idea.
The reason why you're doing this, digging into the side of a mountain underground and building a lead box, is because you don't know what dark matter is, and this is an effort to try to figure out what it is.
Exactly, we're fairly sure that it doesn't have charge, you know, that it doesn't have electricity attached to it, because those are the things which are easy to see. They will affect electrons, and you see a signal in your detector. There are lots of nuclear detectors based on that idea. But as far the present theory, and as I say, it's just the theory, it could be wrong, is that the dark matter is something which does not interact in a, what we call electromagnetic way. You know, it's not got magnetism, it's not got electricity, it doesn't decay in ways that we see other particles coming from it. The only way that it interacts is gravity. And even though you might think gravity is a very strong force, gravity is actually, on a scale compared to electrical forces, very weak. And so we have to try and measure the effect that this dark matter will have on a detector And the only interaction is this small gravity. I mean, you know that if you take a tennis ball and you drop it, the Earth, it drops to the Earth because the Earth has got a strong gravity force on it. But if the tennis ball's in your hands, they do not attract each other with a force that you could feel. They do attract each other. That was Newton's big discovery, that all other matter. However, that force is so weak. And so it's like trying to see tennis balls in your hands, apart from the fact they also attract each other. But that force is extremely weak. So it's that kind of force which we are assuming is the only way in which dark matter interacts. It must interact via gravity. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this effect in the galaxy. As a gravitation.
Is this connected in any way with the understanding that is fairly new that you can measure gravity waves? When I went to university, I had a professor who was teaching basic sciences to us people who didn't understand math. He'd spent years working on Joe Weber, years working on detecting gravity waves. I know somebody else finally did and got a Nobel Prize for it. But is dark matter somehow connected to, well, I'll just throw out a couple things. Is it connected to gravity waves? Is it connected to Radcliffe waves? And is it connected even to quantum entanglement? There you are. Now you know all my physics.
I think the short answer to those questions is we don't know, because we don't know much about dark matter at this stage. Because it interacts gravitationally, it will have be affected by gravity wave. Well, the gravity waves, as you know, is a similar sort of thing which people, as you rightly say, worked for years and years, and even now it has been detected, but there are not big experiments done with it yet, and so on. You know, it's still not that well understood. And I think the same is probably going to be true of dark matter. If somebody comes out with a paper in a year or so which says, "I've now found dark matter," that'll be extremely exciting. We'll definitely win a Nobel Prize. But it'll take a while before people then can figure out, can we measure this in a sort of regular, everyday way? That happened in some other cases. I mean, when people first saw gamma rays, people didn't know what they were, and they were extremely hard to detect. But now we do undergraduate experiments where we measure gamma rays. And with dark matter, it might be the same. But at the moment, it does seem extremely mysterious, and we do not know how it behaves and what else it does. I keep asking people working in the field. I mean, I've been involved in this tunnel, but I've been more involved in the sort of getting rid of the backgrounds. I'm not a real theory expert on dark matter. And I keep asking the experts, you know, does the dark matter come in small little globs, or is it all around us? Is it evenly distributed like the mythical ether? And the answer I get is, that's not quite the right question to ask, or we don't know yet either of those. Let me just mention that there are people, and there were people who believed strongly that maybe dark matter does not exist, and they tried to explain the behavior in the galaxies by saying maybe gravity is a little different to what Newton said. And that's, of course, possible. I mean, we've only measured things in certain areas or in certain regimes. So people came up with very sophisticated theories saying that whenever you're very far away, the gravity is not like we learned at school, mass 1 times mass 2 divided by the distance squared. Maybe it's the distance squared plus some other small factor. And that when things are far away, the gravity is different. So that theory was discussed at many conferences. But from what I gather, people have now decided that on the basis of the way the stars move in the galaxies, that theory does not seem to fly. And people are rejecting that one. And the general belief is that dark matter does exist. And we've seriously got to try and find it, to try and measure it, so that we can make progress in physics.
I unfortunately have to break this postgraduate seminar in theoretical physics for an ad break. We have station identifications and required, and commercial messages also required. But this is the Deep Dive, and we're doing a very deep dive today in dark matter. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guests are Robert Lindsay of UWC and Richard Newman of Stellenbosch University. And we will be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guests today are Richard Newman of Stellenbosch University and Robert Lindsay of University of the Western Cape. And they're planning to dig a humongous cave inside a mountain down near Parle so that they can detect dark matter, which is, as I have now been informed, is not the same as antimatter. And they're doing it so they can get rid of all the noisy business of those nasty cosmic rays, and they can deal with the radiation that comes out of the granite of the mountain because they know it's already there. And since nobody knows exactly what dark matter is or does or how it works or how it gets to us or it's already all around us, the obvious question for me is, what's the practical use, A, of learning more about it, and B, putting it to work in some way? Is there something that the most wild and crazy theoreticians say, if we only had a bucket of dark matter, we could do X? Have I startled you with this question, gentlemen?
I just want to just mention, yes, the detection of the dark matter particle, of course, will represent a significant revolution in understanding of matter. According to the current our current understanding, what is called the standard model of particle physics can basically explain everything that we can see at, for example, the Large Hadron Collider accelerator at CERN. And all other
France, right?
And yes, it's on the border of France and Switzerland. So this will be a big change, and dark matter would then, if it's detected, would have to fit into another framework, which will basically represent a revolution in our understanding of fundamental particles and their interaction. Yes, and of course, as Robbie mentioned, this modified Newtonian theories to explain the astronomical observations, that will also then allow us to discard those theories, because one would then be able to confirm the effect of the dark matter on the rotation without the modified Newtonian theories. So those are the two comments that I have offhand. Robbie, is there anything you want to add?
No, I mean, this is pretty much basic research. And there often are questions, is this worth doing? You know, especially in a country like South Africa, where we've got energy problems and people are looking for work, et cetera, et cetera. All we can say to that is that historically speaking, when people did basic research and found new things, when you find that the nuclei of atoms have spin, now who on this program listening to this cares two hoots that it's got spin? You would think that's a totally bit of information. On the other hand, you have things like magnetic resonance imaging. Many of us have gone for an MRI scan when we break our knee or do something weird. MRI scans is based on that fact that you have spin of nuclei. So if some physicists hadn't, in some people's views, wasted their time and studied the spin of nuclei, this would never have come about. So similarly, we cannot say that dark matter will definitely bring us new gizmos or do something for the environment or for people's lives or whatever. We don't know. However, history has taught us that usually when we understand things better, we can actually achieve something and do something better. And the fact that we understand how elements work mean that we can make pharmaceutical products and things like that. If we didn't understand how materials, crystals work, we would never have been able to make transistors. If we didn't make transistors, we wouldn't have computers, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not saying that dark matter will lead to something which is going to affect all our lives, but it might. And of course, endeavor to actually do things or study these things often lead to new developments. People find new types of detectors which have other uses as well. There are some amazing spin-offs. People always say, quite rightly, that the space race was kind of silly in the one hand. Who cared that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon? It didn't actually change any of our lives. However, the fact that they had to send him up there, he and the other astronauts had to be able to do calculations and do things, and it's extremely expensive to put mass in space, meant that they had to develop smaller and smaller computers. So computers changed from being very inefficient, huge, big things which fill the rooms to being small. And if we didn't have small computers, I wouldn't be able to be on this call on my laptop. You know, laptops wouldn't have developed if people hadn't been trying to make smaller and smaller computers. So you have these obvious spin-offs. We should just mention as well that these are not the dark matter searches is one of the things which is driving these underground labs around the world, but it's not actually the only thing that one can do in these laboratories. Because you're away from cosmic rays, it means that there are other sensitive measurements that you can make which are quite useful. One is radiobiological measurements. I mean, our bodies get affected by radiation. That's why radiation can cause cancer and things like that. So people study that in these underground environments. People have found some very interesting results. We had some talks about that at the workshop we had recently, where people were showing that in these environments where there's no radiation, certain cells would behave differently. And this could actually help to understand how things happen. It turns out that actually a bit of radiation is needed for some mutations. Otherwise, one has problems in the way organisms develop as well.
Soon enough, you will be banging the tin cup and looking for more money to build this thing. And therein is a question. Why spend money on this when there are so many other really, really difficult, really desperate problems that could use a cash infusion in this country? Why not just leave it to the people in the United States or Britain or the European Union or Moscow even to do this and arrange your research projects with them? Why bother to do one here?
Yeah, Brooks, I think the thing is that we can in South Africa contribute to cutting edge science. And we need for our students, for our learners at school, our university students, we also need some projects that can excite them in terms of, you know, the bigger questions, for example, in physics about the universe and so on. There's been, for example, a lot of interest at our university, also in astrophysics recently with some appointments and so on, and also with the presence of the Square Kilometer Array that we have, a world-class instrument to do radio astronomy, but which we have access to in South Africa. A lot of data will be coming from that. And for example, this experiment or this lab that we are thinking of, and especially the dark matter aspect, will basically be complementary. So there's talk about this idea of multi-messenger astronomy, where you look at different types of radiation, radio waves, in our case, dark matter, neutrinos, all related to astronomical processes. This is an opportunity for South Africa, but also for Africa to play a role in this whole field of underground science. As Robbie said, it's not only on the fundamental particle studies, where we're looking at dark matter, for example, but also on biology, on geology, geophysics, where we can make contributions. So I think it's a bit of a dream project in the sense that we can get local South African and African scientists and other collaborators involved in research in South Africa at the pole, and also keep in mind the fact that if the SPOL lab is established, it would only be the second laboratory in the Southern Hemisphere. So there's a unique geographic position that we can exploit by building the lab here. So, yes, so I know there are many challenges in terms of social challenges that we have in South Africa, but I feel that we also need to allow students to dream, and not only to dream, but to actually get involved in some of this cutting-edge science. So I feel that with the poll, we will be able to create such an opportunity.
This is not just the dream of a few mad South African scientists. We are actually an international group looking at this. There's a French group that look at particle physics that's heavily involved in this and pushing this as well. And it will certainly not be something that only South Africans will be using. I mean, these dark matter experiments are usually big international collaborations. I mean, at the University of the Western Cape, I'm involved with a colleague with a big international collaboration called NEXO, N-E-X-O, and that has about 50 universities around the world connected to it. Most of them are in North America, but many in Europe. There are some in China. There are some, well, we in South Africa. Similarly, if we have a dark matter experiment in this tunnel that we're proposing, it will not be an only South African experiment. There will be lots of foreign scientists coming to South Africa, and that interaction with foreign scientists is, of course, extremely valuable. I've seen that in the physics department at the University of the Western Cape. Because South Africa joined the Square Kilometre Array, I now daily talk to people who are astronomers who are visiting there, or one or two have been appointed as well, who are from Portugal, England, Germany, various countries around the world, China. And that is really important creates a really vibrant environment where people don't just sit and think about, oh, what are the problems we've got? That we talk to people about what are the problems in your country, which is often quite interesting to hear that things are not difficult only here. And that interaction leads to coming up with new ideas, new ways of doing things, finding out that this can be a useful way of doing things.
I'm glad you describe the international texture of this kind of work. One of the things I learned about reading about scientific development historically was certainly in the 1600s and 1700s, the 1800s, even before the real establishment of scientific journals, there was a very active exchange between the scholars all over Europe by way of letters. Circular letters that would go to colleagues from England to universities throughout Germany and France and Italy and so forth, and vice versa, and then around. And what you're describing simply says that it speeds up because you're in daily contact, at any given moment, actually. Just before we went for a station break earlier, you talked about the unexpected spin-offs of research. And I was going to joke, well, not really a joke, but say one of the things that came out of the space race, aside from all the real scientific advances and the ability to monitor all manner of things, was also really simple things like Velcro, which everybody on the planet uses pretty much every day for something, to bind shoes together or clothes or whatever, or close compartments. It's all these other devices that work towards our life beyond the big adventure. But can I turn the discussion, and I'll ask you, Robbie, actually, to comment on this. How is this project going to deal with or address or contribute to the need to maintain and improve the flow of young talent in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics worlds? Because the country desperately needs much more of that flow in these days.
Yes, as part of this project, we've right from the start thought about the outreach options. I mean, having a lab like that will certainly be interesting to the school children in Paul, for example. You know, taking them on tours around this lab will be a great start already to let people realize that one can do international science in a local community in Paul. If you are only reading about it on YouTube, you think, well, this is something which happens in America, but having it local is really important. And the great thing has been with the Square Kilometer Array, right from the start, the Department of Science and Innovation said that this shouldn't be a radio astronomy, a radio telescopes in South Africa, which are there for the Europeans. It should be something which South Africa plays an active role in. And they actually supported very strongly many bursaries for South African students, especially Black students. And at the University of the Western Cape, if you walk in there now and you look at the list of postgrad students, you will see many South African students who are working on that project. So right from the start, it was said that this a local thing, local South African thing as well. And South Africa did put in a lot of money in the Square Kilometer Array, not in the telescopes developed by the Europeans, but in our local telescopes, which are called the Meerkat telescopes and radio telescopes. And South Africans have been heavily involved in that, developing them. Engineers have designed certain things around it. Construction has taken place locally and so on. So it has had a big impact on the economy locally, and especially, as I can testify from personal experience at the University of the Western Cape, where 20 years ago we had one astronomer. Now we've got a whole bunch of people there, and especially postgrad students. Now, of course, you could say how many radio astronomers does South Africa need? And the answer is not that many. However, any of these students who have been who have done master's degrees, for example, or PhD degrees, they will have learned how to compute. They will have learned how to, at a very high level, they would have learned how to use computers. They will know about handling big data. That's one of the big aspects of the square kilometer array. And all of those people will be are highly employable. Our problem in South Africa is unemployment is high, but unemployment is not particularly high amongst people who have university degrees. And if you have university degrees in the science and technology fields, you can certainly get a job. I mean, in the program that I'm involved in now, which creates, trains about 30 master students every year, we've been doing a study, and there are hardly any who are unemployed from the students who have been trained in the last 10 years. So that's the message which we must send out there, is that getting high-level science training is an extremely valuable.
Good message to get out. We're going to take one last station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and he's doing a very quick postgraduate course now in nuclear physics with two guests, Robbie Lindsay from UWC and Richard Newman from Stellenbosch. I expect my degree in the mail when we're finished all this. We'll come right back after this for some final words. This is The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as we are here every Friday morning with Richard Newman of Stellenbosch University, Robert Lindsay from UWSC, and they're both cooperating on the will-be-constructed dark matter research facility inside a mountain, inside a tunnel, away from those nasty, troublesome cosmic rays. And we're learning a bit about how science really works. Unfortunately, time runs against us. So if the two of you will each take a minute or so just to pull through the key lesson that you want our listeners to have. Robbie, go ahead first, and then Richard, then you can wrap up, please.
Okay, Brooks, thanks very much for having us. And it's been great talking to you and to the listeners. I think the message is that here is a new idea which we are trying to push as a few scientists in South Africa, and several universities are involved. And we hope that people will realize that this is a valuable thing to do. And we hope that we will get the funding, maybe some funding from abroad as well, so that we can develop this. And we are all hoping that this will have a major useful use in actually getting people to realize how useful science is, and will train a lot of South Africans. Thank you.
No, thank you. Crowdfunding is your watchword, maybe, going forward. Richard, you get last
word. Yes, from my side, as Robbie said, it's an exciting project. We have a unique opportunity. It's a time-sensitive opportunity as well, because of the fact that we are trying to integrate this construction with plans to upgrade the tunnel complex in the Huguenot tunnel complex. So we have to act quite fast. We are busy with the feasibility study that you mentioned at the start. This will take about 3 months, and then we will go to the next step where we'll have to engage further, as you mentioned, to look for further funding to take this further. But if we get everything realized, we would have, in my opinion, a world-class underground laboratory in South Africa, the first in Africa, the second in the Southern Hemisphere, and it will provide a wonderful opportunity for researchers, students, learners to get involved with science at the cutting edge. So that is my closing message.
Well, next time I'm in the Cape area, I'm going to come out and you're going to show me around. We're going to go down the tunnel and you're going to show me where it's going to be. And I'm going to keep an eager lookout, dark matter. This has been Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, particularly deep this time, with two scientists, Richard Newman from the University of Stellenbosch and Robert Lindsay from the University of the Western Cape. And they have been trying to educate me into the mysteries and wonder of dark matter and how it's going to be researched and examined and weighed and measured and spoken gently to in South Africa, way under the ground inside a mountain next to a tunnel. And I thank you both very much for sharing your insights, your knowledge, and your time. This is Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive. And we'll be back again next week with another topic of interest to our listeners. Take care and have a good weekend.